Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Our next guest is Jeff Hecht, who has written a new book called Lasers, Death Rays, and the Long, Strange Quest for the Ultimate Weapon. That title just gets me. I love it. In civilian sectors, the laser has been successfully used for years in fiber optic cables, scanners, medical devices, and industrial cutting tools. Now, as a military weapon, though, the laser has not been successful, but not for lack of trying. From the 1950s sci-fi vision of version of the death ray through the Reagan administration's Star Wars missile defense system and a scheme to bounce laser beams off giant orbiting relay mirrors and more. As the laser as a possible weapon has had a really fascinating and somewhat disappointing history. We're happy to welcome Jeff Hecht to Cool Science Radio. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Lynn.
Well, let's take us back, I mean, really to the early 1900s when some sort of death ray was first discussed.
Yeah, the death ray sort of started as science fiction, but there were also the hope that they could use the new idea of radio waves to do things like disarm or detonate, let's say, mines in the ocean that are sitting in a harbor trying to mine a harbor to make boats explode and to destroy them. So they wanted to find some way to defuse that threat. Mm-hmm. And an Italian engineer came up with a scheme, and he was seemed to be able to detonate the landmines at a distance by turning on his magic F-ray. And, well, it turned out it wasn't actually an F-ray. He had just used his own landmines and added a little bit of sodium to what was inside the mine. The landmine drilled a hole and clogged it with filled it with something that would let water dribble through until it ignited the sodium inside the landmine, and it detonated the explosive. So he had a fake death ray. Didn't really convince anybody in the end, but it was a death ray. And that kind of idea was floating around, especially after World War One and aerial bombing became a threat. And after that, after World War One, military forces were looking around for what can we do to stop aerial bombing? And, well, maybe we could shoot down the planes with death rays. And indeed, you could kind of stop a motor, certain kinds of motors, with enough radio noise. But they never found a death ray. And eventually, the British Air Ministry decided they would have a test that anybody had to pass with their death ray. They would say, can you kill a sheep at 150 yards? And if they could, they'd give them 1,000 pounds, and presumably they'd talk with them about making more of these death rays, but nobody ever managed to pass that test.
So there's some fallacies and some failures within all of these tests, and maybe maybe it goes back even earlier than the early 1900s. And we're fans of Nikola Tesla. We love to talk about him. And every time he weaves his way into a story, we have to ask about it. So going back to the late 1800s, I believe, talk about the foundations there that Tesla was working on. And also Tesla was somewhat failing on.
Yeah, well, Tesla was demonstrating radio transmission very early in the late 1900s. And he also had a plan to go further. If he could send radio signals, why couldn't he send power through the air? And he had this scheme to build a big tower and found a place on Long Island. He talked J.P. Morgan, the eminent financier, whose bank still exists, and giving him $150,000. And Tesla started building this Wardenclyffe facility. He ultimately ran out of money before he finished, but he still had plans, and he still hoped, but eventually he just didn't have the money to go any further. And in reality, he really didn't have the physics that would have worked anyway. He didn't seem to understand too much about how radio waves really propagated through the air. He didn't think they could carry power. He thought that he could send power through the ground, and it would somehow connect through to where the radio waves were going. And it would also go somewhat faster than the speed of light, so he had some little technical problems there. But you know, Tesla did talk later about having a peace ray or a death ray or things like that to stop, and he hoped it would stop all kinds of war. And he was talking about that as late as the 1930s. But people were still thinking here was the great Tesla that had all sorts of wonderful ideas. After he died in 1942 or 1943, the Army sent an MIT professor to go examine all his documents to see, did Tesla really have something? Because they seriously thought Tesla might have had something. And the professor went through his documents. This is a man who was eventually would start a company called High Voltage Engineering. He had worked with Van de Graaff on the Van de Graaff generator. So he knew what he was talking about in these things. And he finally said, no, there's nothing here. Tesla had done some great work, but most of his great work was in the last century. In other words, in the late 1800s. But the professor was quite diplomatic about it. And his name was John Trump. And yes, that is Donald Trump's uncle.
Wow. If you're just joining us, we're having a conversation with Jeff Hecht. He has written Lasers, Death Rays, and The Long Strange Quest for the Ultimate Weapon. Now, popular culture has not really helped this whole thing, because with the technological disappointments in the real world, you've got guys like H.G. Wells in 1898 writing War of the Worlds, where they have these heat rays that are like laser rays. And then Orson Welles, not to be, a different Welles, puts this thing into a radio show and frightens the entire country, having suicides and everything else. But popular culture with Pulp Fiction and with the cheesy B and C class movies really beat the drum for having lasers as the ultimate weapon, didn't they?
Yeah, they certainly set the stage for some kind of directed energy weapon. There was George Pal did a movie version of the War of the Worlds in the 1950s, and in it, the Martian death rays. The Martian death ray. Martians had their death rays, and they landed. We tried to bomb them. We nuked them. The mushroom clouds rose from the sky, and then the Martians emerged, death rays flashing from that. And so we kind of hoped that there would be some kind of ultimate weapon. And when after the Sputnik launch in 1957, the U.S. was getting very, very worried about nuclear missile attack from Russia. So they created what became DARPA, it was then called ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency. And in 1958, that was their big mission, was to find some way to defeat nuclear missiles. So when a guy named Gordon Gould came in into ARPA in early 1959 with a plan to build a laser, they were all ears. And they were especially interested because, hey, this looks physically plausible. And they all, Gould and the company he worked with were asking for $300,000 to start research. And ARPA said, here, take $1 million. And you know, they were all excited about this and immediately, of course, classified everything. And at this point, they run into a little problem. It seemed that Gordon Gould, had, in his ill-spent youth, had been a communist.
Whoops.
And they would never give him a clearance.
Now, on page 84 of your book, you have a tri-service laser or a cosmonaut laser pistol, and it looks almost like my two Star Trek phasers. They're water pistols, but they look. Lynn, I'll bring them in
plastic.
Next week. They're really they are plastic, and
yes,
one leaks. One leaks, the other one doesn't though. And Lynn, I'll bring these in next week. We could
please do. We can have a water fight over the electronic
fight.
Board.
Yeah, I'm going to give you the one that leaks. And but anyway, I'm trying to push popular culture, but there was actually. In your book here, looking at this thing, I mean, it looks just like something from a Hollywood set. It looks like the Star Trek phaser.
Well, that was actually a Russian scheme, and they were going to have their cosmonauts equipped with lasers. Now, at that point, probably all the laser could have done would have been to flash bright pulses of light that might have caused eye damage. And that's a real threat from a handheld laser. But otherwise, you know, a handheld laser wouldn't convey enough power to vaporize anybody. It might vaporize a fly. But you need a larger laser to do that. The Russians didn't actually get this done. I think that was not something they actually made in 1974. And it's actually metallic. It looks, you know, like a real weapon. At that point, roughly at that time, the U.S. was working on a project called the Airborne Laser Laboratory. And what they were doing was putting a laser into a 707. And this was a type of laser that was actually powered by burning something to produce hot carbon dioxide. And that hot carbon dioxide would emit laser light. And the problem was that once you got it up into the plane was vibrating, and it didn't really work very well. And it was big and huge, and the joke in the military became that it was so big that the only militarily useful thing you could do with the airborne laser would be to drop it on the enemy.
If you can't kill them with your laser beam, just smush them.
You're right, it works.
Yeah,
yep.
Exactly. Well, Jeff, you are, I would describe you as being, well, an award-winning freelance science and technology writer, but you are somewhat obsessed with the laser. I mean, from a contributing editor to Laser Focus World magazine, and you've written books about understanding lasers and understanding fiber optics and the race to make the laser. I'm wondering, of all of the experiments with lasers throughout the ages, what's your most favorite story about an attempt to or somewhat succeeding to make an effective laser?
Well, I think in one way, one of my favorite stories is actually the first laser that Theodore Maiman made at Hughes Research Laboratories. It was a piece of ruby, a little fingertip-shaped piece of ruby. And ruby can emit red light, and that was what he was trying to do. And he was working with his assistant named Ernie DeHaan, and Ernie happened to be colorblind. He couldn't see red. Hmm. So they're working on this experiment, and what they're using is a photographer's flash lamp and trying to use the light from that flash lamp to excite the chromium atoms that make ruby emit red light to produce enough laser power to see. So they were flashing the laser, the flash lamp, and flashing and turning the voltage up, and flashing and turning the voltage up, and flashing again. And eventually, they had this brilliant, you know, red flash that made a little sort of circle on the wall and lit up the whole room. And DeHaans, who had never seen red before, could see that red light because it was so bright. And it was also my favorite experiment because it worked the first time. Maiman had calculated so well and engineered it so well that it worked the first time. And they didn't even have a very good ruby crystal.
Well, although your book discusses in length about the quest for the ultimate weapon, lasers we use in our everyday lives. And it's funny, I was thinking about the laser pointer when those first came out, and kids in school that would be, you know, pranking with the laser pointer and pointing them at people, and you didn't know where it was coming from because you weren't really used to having a laser pointer pointed at you. How do lasers enter into our lives most frequently?
Well, I think we're talking over a laser beam right now.
Yes.
I have an optical fiber to my home. There's optical fibers all the way across the country that are carrying my voice, your signal, that it's transmitted over the internet. If your people are accessing your website, it'll come back to people via laser beam.
Yep.
So that's certainly one way that you see. There's a whole new way of use of laser technology that people are talking about in autonomous cars, where you'd all have things called LIDAR, laser radar. And what they do is the lasers would pulse, and build up a map of the world around the car so that it would know how far away everything is. People are already using that technology for things like measuring the atmosphere and for making maps of fossils so they can reproduce the shape, exact shape of a fossil, say if someone had a fossil dinosaur. Or to map a dig site. So there's, you know, those are just, you know, two of the things. You know, one something we do all the time, and one something that, you know, in 5 or 10 years we may be driving around with a little laser spinning on top of the car, and map, you know, keeping track of where everything is.
Exactly. Well, for this conversation that we're having on a fiber optic line, I want to mention that. It's probably using spectral beam technology where many conversations and many pictures and some movies are being streamed on the same fiber line, all at different frequencies. And we have our own little frequency that we've connected this morning on. But spectral beam technology has been used in fiber optics on the commercial side for a number of years. Is it working its way into research for current weapons from the Pentagon?
Yes, that's one of the interesting things, and it's actually one of the most promising technologies out there right now. There are prototypes out in the out being tested that use this technology. And what you have, the lasers that they're using, strange as this may seem, the lasers are optical fibers. They're thin glass fibers that have material in them that emit light when it's excited by other light, much like Ted Maiman's laser. But in this case, you've got a number of these fibers, each operating in a different wavelength, so that when you put all those wavelengths together into another fiber, if you tried the same wavelength, you'd run into trouble because waves might bump up against each other. But if you use different wavelengths, you can pack them all into one a little bit larger fiber, and you can get 60 kilowatts of laser light or 100 kilowatts of laser light in some of the new ones, and because no single thin fiber could carry that much light. But with combining them all into a thicker fiber from separate wavelengths, then you could build up a lot of power, and it's a breakthrough in this in the field.
Wow, that's all great stuff to hear. The book is Lasers, Death Rays, and the Long Strange Quest for the Ultimate Weapon. Our guest is Jeff Hecht. He's a science technology writer. And we're so glad, Jeff, that you could join us on Cool Science Radio. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. Take care.
Okay, you too.